Hey, and welcome to everyone who's online and to Southeast. Sam Taylor is sick, so my apologies for that. You're stuck with me, so it's not too late to run. But we've locked the doors here, so it's too late for all of you. Would you open up, if you've got a Bible with you, we're up to 2 Samuel chapter 11, and if you've been waiting, this is the morning that we get to chapter 11, because today we're talking about David and Bathsheba. And if you've been waiting for this, yes, we finally got there. And if you've been thinking, if you forgot where we were up to and you would plan to skip this particular sermon, it's too late. Here we are. I don't know if you've been appreciating the pictures that have been drawn each, the pieces of art that have been drawn each week. Yeah, really good, eh? I noticed that this week the picture of David and Bathsheba is much further back on the stage, which is just fortunate, isn't it? I was going to say lucky, but you can't say lucky in church. So we're going to pick up the story. Chapter 11. And actually what we're going to find in this chapter is actually, I know it's like written like 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. And it's describing events on the other side of the world. But what happens here, I actually think, is so profoundly relevant to our lives here today. Because it seems to me that if anybody was ever going to be excused, if anybody was going to be above or beyond the reach of their dark side, it was David. Like, his first global celebrity. He's at the peak of his powers as we hit the beginning of chapter 11. And he's described in this with this language, and I'm sure you're familiar with it if you've been in church any amount of time. He's the man after God's own heart. Like, he's meant to be the guy. And even that turn of phrase, it sounds like, because we translate, almost like transliterated straight from Hebrew into English, man after God's own heart. It sounds like he's meant to be, he's so devout. He's got such great character. That's actually not what the turn of phrase is driving at. He's a person after God's own heart, chosen according to God's heart. He's chosen by God. Unlike every other king on the face of the earth who was chosen or elected or however they were put in their position of power and authority, it was because what people wanted. But that's not the case with Israel's king. This was God's choice. If anybody was going to be above and beyond temptation and above and beyond the power of sin, surely it's David. But here's the thing. What happens here in chapter 11 happens not because David's a bad man, but because he's a mortal man. And as we read through these few verses together, it's like a masterclass, an absolute masterclass in exactly what not to do. Like, there's no chapter in the Bible where somebody gets it wronger, if that's a word, than David does in this chapter. Admittedly, Adam and Eve don't do well, in Genesis, early Genesis. But David's a close second. But it actually has so much to say to us. So 2 Samuel chapter 11 verse 1 says this. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, and not just any old kings, wildly successful kings at the peak of their power. Kings like David. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army, and they destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem. And as is so often the case in 1 and 2 Samuel, the opening verse or two set the scene for everything that's going to happen. And that's exactly what the writer of 2 Samuel does here. David is at the peak of his powers. He secured Jerusalem as his capital. There's a united kingdom. Israel's glory and renown and fame will never be greater than it is right now. The Ammonites, they're just the latest example of a victory in a long line of great victories by David and his military forces. He's powerful, he's influential, he's wealthy, he is a global superstar. He's published poetry and songs They are so anointed that they've decided to include them in the Bible. That's pretty anointed, don't you think? And if anybody's going to be above and beyond temptation and sin, surely it is David. And yet there's this contrast that's continually set all the way through this chapter with David and basically all the key other characters in this story. And it starts here with Joab and the military forces, because they're heading out to do God's work, to fight God's fights, to secure, to not only enter but secure the promised land. That's what they're doing, but not David. David remains in Jerusalem. Dun, dun, dun. This isn't going to end well. So verse 2 continues. As David has remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. The way that phrase walked around is what he was doing was pointless and aimless. And the key question is this: what on earth is he walking around on the roof in the middle of the night when he's remained, but all of his closest confidants and lieutenants, they've all headed out doing God's work, but he's remained back. And now he finds himself walking on the roof of the palace. Well, from the roof, he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful. And David sent someone to find out about her. And the man said, "She's Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." And I know it's 3,000, 4,000 years old, this story. And I know it's the other side of the world. But I'm reading this story and I'm going, this is how temptation always works. It starts, I think I might just hang back at Jerusalem. I can't sleep tonight. I think I might go for a walk. Do I take the dog for a walk or go for a walk on the roof? The roof's pretty harmless. I'm just going for a walk. Oh, there's no one here. I might just go for a walk on the roof. And he knows exactly why he's walking on the roof. He hasn't told anybody, but he knows exactly why he's walking on the roof. Because the roof is right next to Bathsheba's bathroom. And he knows exactly where her bathroom is. This is not the first time. Now again, it's not because he's a bad man, it's because he's a mortal man. And he's faced with what tempts him. And what tempts him always starts with, well, you know, I've been leading a lot of battles. I'll just stay. But the first step becomes the second, becomes the third, becomes the 12th pretty soon. And the language here, he saw her bathing. And it says this, literally, she was very beautiful in my trusty NIV. Literally, it says, she was exceedingly desirable to lingeringly look at. And so the glance becomes a gaze. The look becomes a linger. The peep becomes a perv. And it's not because he's a bad man, he's a mortal man. And he's just started his masterclass on how not to deal with temptation. He continues, and the deceit and the rot starts to set in even more. David sent someone to find out about her. Ew, there seems to be a woman bathing next door. Well, I wonder who she is. Give me a break. Jerusalem at this time was 10 acres big. I googled that. That's 4 MCG playing surfaces big. Which if you're playing AFL, like Carlton last night, I'm sorry, Carlton, not Carlton. Carlton, poor Carlton. Good on the demons. You can't say that in church, can you? Good on, oh, I'm so glad for the demons. That's 4 MCGs. That's big if you're playing football. But if it's your capital city, that's small. You know everyone. He knows where a bathroom is. He knows exactly who it is. He knows exactly what time she takes a bath. But oh no, I'm going to live in denial. That's much better. No one's around. Well, I don't need any help. I can do this by myself. This is completely under control. And yet it never, ever is. It's interesting, the messenger returns and said, she's Bathsheba. This nameless messenger is the only person who ever uses her name in this story. The only person who ever gives her enough dignity to use her name. The rest of the time she's the woman. She's her. She's she. She's the wife. She's sent for. She's brought in. She's conquered. And again, I get that this is 3,000 years old, this story. I get that this is the other side of the world. But isn't that how it works? So often in our lives, in this day, in this age? Isn't that so often in our culture, how we treat women? Like commodities. Not someone's daughter, not someone's wife. Our thing. And we forget in the moment, we don't mean any harm, but we forget in the moment, don't we? We forget in the moment that this, we've turned someone's mother or someone's daughter or someone's sister into a thing for our pleasure, our gratification, and our enjoyment. And we're thinking about no one else except ourselves. It's interesting. Because so often in our day and our age, our culture, our global culture, so often the way that women are viewed or presented or talked about or sung about is as commodities. And that's the essence of the problem. Don't covet your neighbor's wife. The essence of lust is this, turning somebody into a commodity for your enjoyment. You know, this is how, on our Spotify, our Apple Music playlists, this is how we sing about women. You know, I've got three boys. There are two words that are banned from my boys' playlists. You know what they are? Two words. Bitch and whore. I will not have those words on my boys' playlists. I will not have it. And yet this man, after God's own heart, he's doing exactly what so many of us do. Someone's daughter, someone's mother, someone's sister on a screen. Well, it's free. It's not hurting anybody. Me doing it's not adding to anything, really. And we're doing exactly what this man is doing in this story. Verse 4 says this. Then David sent messengers to get her. Like an order from the grocery store. And she came to him and he slept with her. It's the language of sexual conquest. In brackets. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness. The reason she's bathing, it's because she's trying to be right with God. She's trying to follow the Torah. She's trying to live a devout life. And David turns her purity into his perversion. And then she went back home. And the woman conceived and sent word to David saying, I am pregnant. So David sent this word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Jacob sent him to David. You notice the repetition of the word there? Sent, 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 sent. The repetition reinforces a key idea. David thinks he's got this whole thing under control. He thinks that so long as I can just manipulate and manufacture and I can try and control circumstances, this is not going to get away from me. I'm going to handle this by myself. No one else needs to know. Here's the thing. Someone else needs to know. If you try and fight temptation by yourself, you're a train wreck waiting to happen. Not because you're bad, but because you're mortal. So David's here, trying to manipulate and manufacture. I've got all of this under control. Send, 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 send. I can handle this. Just one more time. I'll just do one more thing. Tomorrow I'll stop. Problem is, the tomorrow will stop strategy is tomorrow in 24 hours will be today, and tomorrow will be one day more. Does it sound familiar? I'll never do it again, I promise. I'm so sorry, I'll never do it again. And we try and fight the battle by ourselves, and we try and live the lie that somehow I've got it under control. Can I please say to you, you don't have it under control. I know you're lovely. You're not that lovely. And neither's David. Verse 7 says this. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was and how the soldiers were and how the war was going. And then without even waiting for a reply, because he's got a plan, or at least the next stage of his catastrophic plan. Verse 8, then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. But that turn of phrase in Hebrew isn't about personal hygiene. It's about sex. Wash your feet. Get some sex. Here's the plan. If Uriah sleeps with Bathsheba, people will think that the child is his child. No one will ever guess. It's not like no one will ever know. But here's the thing. Everybody knows. He thinks nobody understands what's going on. They all do. They're just too scared to say anything. So Uriah left the palace and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants and did not go down to the house. And David was told, Uriah did not go home. And so he asked Uriah, haven't you just come from a military campaign? Why didn't you go home? And then, so ironic what David now says Uriah says to David. Because it's the very words that David used to Nathan in chapter 7 when he said, how can I live in a palace when God's ark lives in a tent? It was David at his best. And now the very same language is used by Uriah when David's at his worst. And Uriah said to David, the ark in Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and my Lord's men are camped in the open ground. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. And then David said to him, stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back. And so Uriah, and again, this is the language of verse 1, when this whole sorry, sordid tale started. It says Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. And at David's invitation, he ate and drank with him. And David made him drunk. Oh my goodness. He's now getting him drunk. He thinks he's under control, but it is unraveling before his eyes, which is how it always works. It always works that way. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants, and he did not go home. And you notice how in these verses, the writer's dropping into a level of detail that he didn't start with? And the writer's dropping into that level of detail to slow down the action, to sharpen the contrast. Uriah the Hittite. Uriah the Hittite. From a people who once upon a time were Israel's enemies, this man's found faith in God. In fact, he's not a stranger to David. He's actually one of his mighty men. 30 closest friends, closest loyal lieutenants, the people who have, of everybody on the face of the earth, who would give their life for David, Uriah's one of them. And he's the man of integrity in this story, not David. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. And in it he wrote, put Uriah out in front where the fighting is fiercest, and then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die. Do you understand? Do you see what's happening? That's Uriah's death warrant. You see who's carrying it to Joab? Uriah. And he's got so much integrity, he doesn't even look because he trusts David. He'd give his life for David. David, what are you doing? Verse 16, so while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. And when the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. And Joab sent David a full account of the battle. The next few verses, which we won't read, but we'll just move to verse 25. But Joab gives his full account. And it's the communication from a person who's completely conflicted with what's going on. Because he's David's nephew, and it's like he trusts David implicitly. And he knows that Uriah is one of David's closest guys. And he knows that David doesn't act like this, but he wants Uriah killed. And so he obeys him. He's loyal to David, but he's loyal to Uriah as well. And he does what David says, even though he doesn't understand, because his submission is total. But he's so conflicted. But here's the thing. David thinks he's under control, thinks he's handling this. But it's unraveling before his eyes. Because it started with the 10th commandment. Do not covet your neighbor's wife. It started there. Well, it's only number 10. It's only number 10. It's not even the 7th most important one. It's the 10th most important one. Or at least there are 9 way more important commandments than the 10th one. So it's only 10th. It's only. Does that sound familiar? Just this one time? Never again. I'm so sorry. It'll never happen again. I'll stop tomorrow. I didn't mean it. But you see, as it always is the case with temptation, the 10th commandment becomes the 6th commandment. Don't commit adultery. And as things unravel and escalate, the 6th commandment becomes the 7th commandment. Don't kill people. Don't murder them. And here's the thing. Way too often, we try and put the brakes on only when we have to, or the consequences are immediate and catastrophic. And until that happens, we use exactly the strategy that David's using, that only gives temptation oxygen that it will take to unravel and escalate what's going on in our lives. And it's not because we're bad. It's because we're normal. Verse 25 says this, and David told the messenger after Joab's report, say this to Joab, don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as another. Press the attack against the city and destroy it. Say this to encourage Jacob. What he means is, say it so he can be reassured. Encourage him. What it means is this, make sure he does it. And when Uriah's wife, her name's Bathsheba, would somebody please use her name? When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. And after the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. The time of mourning, 7 days. 7 days. Uriah's body is not even cold before David puts the next part of his cover-up in process. And then this final statement that informs, and we need to understand in order to understand any of this story. It says, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. And embedded in that statement are 2 key things that if we are going to navigate temptation and we're going to live a kind of life where sin and its power doesn't have its sway in our lives. 2 key ideas that are embedded in this statement. The thing David did had displeased the Lord. The first is this. It is not under control. You are not in control. I mean, that's life. You know, I don't feel like life's out of control. Life is out of control. Control is a myth. But it's definitely a myth in the area of temptation. It is not under control. One more time, never again, by myself. I've got this. I'm handling this. No one else needs to know. It doesn't work. It only escalates and unravels things. So embedded in that idea that this displeased the Lord, the first idea is that you are not in control. And the second is this, there is more at stake in temptation than what is in front of you right now. We think it's my willpower, my won't power, my never again power. And this is not hurting anyone else power, but what is in front of us. And generally it's not all at once, but always in the face of temptation. What's at stake is our faith, our family, and our future. And it will erode those things if we give temptation oxygen. Now, it's interesting because I think that this story is a masterclass from the man after God's own heart of exactly what not to do in the face of what tempts you. And I don't know what tempts you. It's that thing, it's those things that you are vulnerable to. And that differs with different people. But there's at least three things that David did not do that I think are mission critical if we're going to navigate temptation. Yeah. And so I just want to share them ever so briefly with you. Three simple things. Super, super simple. But sometimes they're hard. Does that make sense? Super, super. When I say what they are, you're going to go, I know that already. Teach me something new, preacher. Not today. Not today. But I'm not tempted. I go to Crossway Baptist Church. Whatever. No. Not today. Not today. Because it's not bad people. It's people who are tempted. Jesus was tempted. Have you ever let that sink in? What happened in the wilderness was not a pantomime with a preordained outcome. It's temptation. Part of living life is walking through temptation. Three simple, simple things that are sometimes hard, but always simple. The first is this. If we're going to navigate temptation, the first is this. Don't live in shame. The thing about temptation, and it's fueled by this power that sin has, that actually the first reference to sin in the book of Genesis says, sin wants to master you. It wants to have you. There's power. It's not just rules and regulations, breaking or not breaking rules. There's a power in sin. And the power in sin wants to do this with you. It wants to make shame the loudest voice in your life. Way louder than God's voice and way louder than the voices of the people who love you and believe in you the most. It wants to isolate you and let shame scream at you. So if we're going to deal with temptation, we need to not live in shame. How do I know if I'm living in shame? It's really easy to tell. You will be doing one or more of these things. You will be keeping secrets. You'll be hiding the truth. You'll be lying, manipulating, isolating from people, and living in denial. Harsh, but super simple and obvious to identify. No one needs to know. It's better if no one knows. If someone else knows, it will be worse. That is shame screaming at you. And of all the people on earth, the people who don't have to live with shame is us. Because Jesus took the shame. so we don't have to be defined by our failure anymore. Do you know how wonderful that is? I don't have to live. I'm not defined by failure, and my life is not defined by regret. Don't live in shame. We cannot grow when we are in shame, and we cannot use shame to change ourselves or change other people. Don't live in shame. The second is this: face your core temptations. What tempts you? You need to be able to name what tempts you. Because if you leave that unnamed or those things unnamed, it gives them a power over you you don't need them to have. If you stay vague, abstract, and blaming other people, you're in trouble. You're lovely. You're not that lovely. And it's interesting because temptation always comes down to one or a mix of just three things. Every time. Approval, appetite, ambition. It's always one or more of those things. Approval, appetite, ambition. And the thing is, each of those three things actually represent a legitimate need. Approval. I need to be loved. I do. Appetite. I have needs. Absolutely, I have needs. And ambition, I need to live with purpose. You cannot live without purpose greater than yourself. It can't be done. But here's the key question. Will you meet a legitimate need in an illegitimate way? That's the power of temptation. So key question in this space is this. What are your triggers? You should know what they are. And if I can put that three ways, who are the people that if you are with them, you're more likely to be tempted? Who are the people? They'll cross your boundaries or they'll let you loosen yours. Who, when you violate people with what you say or do, they won't challenge you to live better and be who you are. Who are the people? Where are the places? David, what on earth were you doing on the roof? You'd think. Don't go on the roof. Don't go on the roof. What are the people? What are the places? And what are the pressures? For some of us, it's actually the responsibilities in life right now that weigh so heavily, they'll push us to embrace temptation just to feel better. So don't live in shame, face your core temptations. And just one more, widen your circle. We teach and train our young people in this all the time. Widen your circle of relationships. There's this proverb, it's not in the Bible, it's a good one. It takes a village to raise a child. You heard that? It's good, but it's only half the story. It takes a village for any of us to do life well. You don't graduate from the village. And here's the great tragedy of Australian culture. Cultures. Most men over 40 in Australia have no friends. Acquaintances, workmates, drinking buddies, people who are part of a sporting team, people who egg you on to be a man and pretend that that's courage. We do that, but we've got no friends. The key to being able to navigate temptation is this. You need to be able to be vulnerable with somebody who is trustworthy. Question, who are those people in your life? If you can't name them or introduce me to them, you're in trouble at some point. They should know stuff that you can't control their response. Let me just say this. If they're not trustworthy, don't tell them anything. They are a disaster. Give them the widest berth. Walk around the roof. But if they trust, if they've earned the right to hear your story, because you experience acceptance without judgment with them, but also the challenge to grow and change and live out who you really are, those people. There won't be many, but there needs to be some. Who are they? And I can only speak on behalf of men at this point, because I is one. White, middle-aged man, such as I am. If you don't have trustworthy people in your life right now or in the near future, you are a disaster waiting to happen. Not because you're bad, because you're human. Don't live in shame. Don't live in shame. Face your core temptations. That's not an exercise in shame. That's an exercise in honesty and holiness. And widen your circle. Would you pray with me? Would you pray with me? Just heads bowed and eyes are closed. We don't often do this as a congregation when we're all gathered together. But just as heads are bowed and eyes are closed, I want you to just pause and maybe think of what tempts you. Or maybe just in this space, think of what you've given in to. Where temptations become sin. They're two different things. But neither of those two things are meant to be a dead end, a bottomless chasm, a point of no return. Neither temptation nor sin are ever intended to be those things. And so therefore not meant to be a source of shame, though so often they are. So maybe think of that point of temptation, or maybe that point of sin and failure. And I want to read you just ever so briefly a few words that David spoke in this situation. Psalm 51, if you're interested, of where it comes from. He prayed this in the aftermath of this debacle. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. His love cannot fail. That's what unfailing means. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Blot out. Not cross out, blot out. Not free pass, dealt with. Blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity. Let that sit. All my iniquity. Yes, please. And cleanse me from my sin. Just in the quietness, pray this prayer, Lord, forgive me and cleanse me from my sin. And if you prayed it, whether you believe it or not, receive it. What is given only is worth anything if it is received. Otherwise, it's just held out there to dry. God has mercy on you. God's love for you is unfailing. His compassion for you is great. Your transgressions have been blotted out. All your iniquity is washed away, and your sin is cleansed. In the name of Jesus. And everybody who needs that kind of mercy said, Amen.